welcome, listeners, to another edition of The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. This is Dr. Z, Dr. Eugene Zampro, naturopathic physician, and we're really glad that you took time to investigate the program and listen to it and hear information about health, wellness, and issues in medicine, alternative and complementary, naturopathic. And today, Ayurvedic, we're really excited to have our guest today. And remember, you can always get more information about myself and the natural nurse who has the day off by visiting our websites. That's naturalnurse.com and drznaturally.com, our walks and talks and eco tours and things like that. We're doing a lot of stuff in the fall, so look at the calendar if you get a chance. So today we have a very interesting book on healing the thyroid with Ayurvedic medicine, natural treatments for Hashimoto's and hypothyroidism and even hyperthyroidism, with our guest, Dr. Marianne Teitelbaum. And Marianne is a chiropractor who spent a lot of time studying Ayurvedic medicine at a deep, deep level, including studying with Dr. Rothenberg and Dr. Vita Ramakant Mishra. And she's a recipient of we'll ask her about this award that she won. It's called Prana Ayushudhi Award. And she lectures and writes extensively about Ayurvedic treatments for all disease. And that's a whole other discipline of medicine that we're going to get a chance to get into today. And she practices and lives outside of Philadelphia. Excuse me. And she wrote this book recently, Healing the Thyroid with Ayurveda, because I guess there's a plague of thyroid disease that we're seeing. And she says here in the book, revealing how the thyroid is a victim of many factors that conspire to create ill health, and how many cases of thyroid disease go undiagnosed. Dr. Teitelbaum focuses on not only treating thyroid problems and symptoms, but reversing them. And she outlines basic principles of Ayurveda, including pulse diagnosis, and explains a successful treatment protocol she's developed over more than 30 years of Ayurvedic practice. And she talks about the underlying reasons for thyroid malfunction, which are sort of accepted in alternative consciousness and alternative types of medicine, like inflammation, or inflammaging, as I like to call it, malnutrition, yet we live in the developed world, yet we're still malnourished, toxins, and how the thyroid is connected to the rest of the body. So we're really excited to have her. Welcome, Dr. Teitelbaum.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Great. So let's talk about, I mean, this is fascinating that here you are, a Western-trained chiropractic physician who went to Palmer College, where chiropractic began, and then you kind of took an interesting U-turn in a way, although they both are natural fields of medicine, chiropractors being doctors of the nervous system, as my chiropractor likes to point out all the time I go for an adjustment. And then you got interested in Ayurveda. Tell us a little bit about your journey.
Well, I actually went to chiropractic college knowing that I would be using Ayurveda, but I always wanted to treat all the diseases. And to do that, you need to have a medical degree. You can't just study some alternative medicine and open up an office. Especially here in New Jersey, you need to be licensed. So I always loved the chiropractic philosophy of adjusting the spine to keep the flow of the life energy. We call it prana in Ayurveda, but here in the West, Western chiropractic colleges, they call it innate intelligence. But it's the flow of the life energy, the nervous energy down the spine into all the organs and gland systems. So once I was finished chiropractic college, during that time, there weren't even any Ayurvedic doctors here. It was in the very early 1980s, in fact, 1980 to 1984. There wasn't any capability of studying Ayurveda. It was almost like the minute I got done school, the very next month, the first wave of Ayurvedic physicians came to the United States and started training us. So I continued my studies, but now I was a chiropractor and studying Ayurveda, and then as the years went by, I incorporated it more and more deeply into my practice.
So Ayurvedic medicine is, I've also studied it for many years and I've had opportunities. Some of my classmates are actually some of the more well-known Ayurvedic physicians in the country. I'm excited, like Dr. Virinder Sodhi, he's out in Washington, and his company is Ayush Herbs, and has a successful practice. He's a naturopath and Ayurvedic physician from India. And Dr. Samesh Kaushik, who also is an Ayurvedic physician and taught at the University of Bridgeport, where I'm a professor there in the College of Naturopathic Medicine. So I've taken some classes, but certainly just scratched the surface. This is a lifelong endeavor, studying Ayurvedic medicine. Tell us a little bit about Ayurveda, and then we'll get more deeply into it.
Ayurveda is a 5,000-year-old tradition of holistic medicine from India. And when I first opened my practice, I always wanted to use herbs in my practice because they're truly natural. They're grown in nature. They're not synthetically made like the vitamin supplements that we sometimes use a little too much in this country. This is a truly natural system. And with this system, it's been around for so long that it's time-tested. So here in America, because we don't have an established, long-standing tradition of holistic medicine, we're trying our best to provide our patients with alternatives, but we're still not sure what a correct diet is or maybe what correct cleansing is. But they figured all this out in Ayurveda thousands of years ago, so it's good to see what those ancient doctors had to say. And oddly enough, it's very relevant for this modern era. And if you look in my book, you'll see hundreds of research articles at the end of the book, so I can show the patient that all the herbs we use, all the cleanses we do, the diet we recommend, it's all been well-researched. Because sometimes people think that it's this ancient tradition, and it's not up-to-date and relevant in this modern era, but the opposite's true.
It's interesting, yeah. So Ayurveda has ancient history. We don't know where it came from exactly, from the Vedas coming down, but you were saying that it's very ancient, predates even Buddha and Christ, and these seers or rishis were able to somehow tap into this cosmic knowledge and figure out these things, maybe some trial and error, but maybe mostly through meditation and understanding the ways of the cosmos. Tell us a little bit about that part of Ayurveda.
Ayurveda was cognized by these ancient rishis in deep meditation. They were enlightened, and they said that when knowledge comes to you when you're enlightened, like Christ, Buddha, Krishna, that it's non-changing. And so it's exactly true what they were saying. Everything they've ever said, at first glance we thought, oh no, maybe they're incorrect about this. But then it turned out that the Western research proved it to be true in every case. And there are many instances that I point out in the book. So, in fact, the opposite's true. There are many times here in the West when, because we're not basing our medical system on this cognizing, because we're enlightened, but we're looking at research, the research can fluctuate. And sometimes they'll say, oh, you know, eggs are good for you. And then they'll say, oh, no, the cholesterol's bad. And oh, no, it is. And maybe cholesterol clogs the arteries, but oh, no, maybe it's just the LDL. But maybe it's the small LDL. But you know what? The last article I read said it's none of the LDL, and cholesterol's really good for the arteries. So that's the kind of changing knowledge we have here in the West, but Ayurveda isn't like that. So when I put a patient on a diet or a cleanse, I feel secure in the knowledge that what I'm doing today won't change 30 years from now.
I love it. That's a wonderful way to say it. So when you break down Ayurveda, first of all, when you train, you have to understand the language of it is all in Sanskrit, and Ayurvedic doctors learn through reciting poems, and then there's the great Ayurvedic books, the fundamental works. And then you have to understand about the channels and the dhatus and the ojas and the doshas. Maybe you can, like, decipher some of these sometimes intimidating words for patients.
You know, we all have some, we call it dharma in Ayurveda. We were all put on this earth to do our life's work, and it's really wonderful if you can figure out what that is. Early on, I understood that the need here in the West is that we need to exactly do what you said. We need to decipher those ancient texts because they're full of gems of knowledge. But here in the West, we don't understand the Sanskrit terms. So if you look in my book, I'm bridging that gap. I'm talking slightly about the Sanskrit terms, but I'm always talking about it in a way that a Westerner could understand, because I have read some books from doctors from India, and I can't quite understand what they're saying. But I was fortunate in that the master Ayurvedic physician that I sat with for 20 years of my practice, he taught me from those ancient texts, and he showed me the Sanskrit, and then he made it more palatable to the Western ear, you know. So I understood what he was saying in a Western sense. So that's what this book is about. It's also about the fact that most of the books written on Ayurveda are very general. They're just about basic elements of Ayurveda. We call them Vata, Pitta, Kapha, or a little bit about the toxins known as Ama. But really, if you look, there haven't been too many Ayurvedic physicians here in the West who have written about specific diseases. So I decided I'm going to write about every disease before I pass, but I started with the thyroid because it's the most common malady that I treat in my practice every day, all week long, all month long, all year long. So I started with that. But you'll see other books coming out where I'll be talking about all diseases.
Yeah, but, you know, what's interesting is Ayurveda goes always by that classic saying, treat the patient who has the disease, not the disease the patient has. That summarizes, I think, in a couple of words, the beauty of Ayurveda, where it's not just like an algorithm for like, okay, you have this disease, then everyone gets this treatment. It's individualized, and part of your work as an Ayurvedic physician is to understand the patients that's experiencing this manifestation called the disease. Am I right about that understanding?
Yeah,
about Ayurveda? That's
exactly
the beauty about it, I think. One size doesn't fit all in Ayurveda.
That's right. We have no cookie-cutter approach. In fact, I wrote about that in the preface to the book, that we have been so trained by doctors. People will come to me with a thyroid problem or another problem, and they'll say, what herbs do you have for the thyroid? And I'll tell them, it doesn't work like that. I could have 100 thyroid patients lined up, or any other patient, ulcerative colitis, diabetes, whatever it might be, but the underlying cause or causes are different in each person, and it's especially true with the thyroid. Just yesterday, I had about 12 thyroid cases, and every single one of them had a different reason why their thyroid was weak. So if you can identify the specific reasons in that patient, fix that, and then you support the thyroid gland with the herbs, it perks back up. See, we don't give the thyroid gland any opportunity to heal in America. If you have low thyroid, you'll go to a doctor, they'll put you on the thyroid hormone. Everybody gets thyroid hormone, and then your thyroid goes into hibernation because it's no longer called upon to make its hormones. But there wasn't any attempt there to practice what I call the art of practicing medicine, to actually heal something and to figure out in that patient why the thyroid's faltering so you could fix it. And that's the message in my book. We can heal our bodies. We just have to know how to nudge it in the correct direction.
So there's many stages of disease in Ayurveda, and you say that there's 9 stages of disease. Let's talk a little bit about those.
Okay. Basically, we could talk about the first 6. The last 3 are when you're kind of on death's doorstep, and I don't see patients in those stages so much. But the way modern medicine views something, you can either be healthy or you have a disease. They don't recognize that there's any in between. You show up on their steps one day and you have cancer and they say, oh, you know, it's not your fault, it just happened. And if you ask them why it happened or why any disease happened, why do I have diabetes? Why is my cholesterol going up? Why is my thyroid weak? They don't have an answer for you. And that's because they don't have any way of detecting imbalances. We call them imbalances in Ayurveda. So the ancient doctors said this. They said, as we go through life, the body will go out of balance in these 6 stages. In the first 2 stages, something could be out of balance. Let's say, for example, one of the very common problems I see with thyroid is the person is drinking fluoridated tap water. Fluoride is a known poison to the thyroid gland, and it attaches to the thyroid gland, and over time it kills it. So you could be drinking your tap water, and in those first two stages, you don't notice any symptoms of hypothyroidism. But if you continue to do it, and no one's telling you to stop doing that, in the third and fourth stage, you'll start to experience symptoms like weight gain, hair loss, constipation, depression, fatigue, irregular menstrual cycles, and so on and so on. So you'll go to your doctor, they'll run thyroid blood work, and it looks normal. And they say, nothing's wrong with you. So you leave the office feeling very frustrated and hopeless. But in the fifth and sixth stage, if you keep drinking that fluoridated tap water, eventually your thyroid is going to become diseased. Then it will show up in blood work, and then you can see the mistake modern medicine makes. Then they put you on thyroid hormone. But no one's there to say, stop drinking the fluoridated tap water. That's just one example, but again, there's many reasons why a thyroid gland could be weak. But that's why the ancient doctor said, identify imbalances, which we do through the pulse, and reverse them, because they said imbalances are easy to reverse. If you let it progress through those six stages, it becomes more and more difficult to reverse. Not impossible, but it will take much more time, and in some cases it is impossible. So that's the goal of medicine. So you can see right off the bat that medicine as we know it here in the West isn't being practiced the way it should be.
Right, like, and also, I might add, bleach and bromine are big problems, too, because they're kind of halogens like fluorine. And so when I see a kid that's drinking orange soda and orange crush all the time, or someone that's overusing bleach around the house, I often will mention that those are toxins for the thyroid, and they're sort of like, really? I'm just drinking soda.
Yeah, there's many reasons why thyroid problems are epidemic. See, the thyroid is the only gland who uses iodine, and it's a halogen. So when these other halogens come into the body, they go right to the thyroid gland. It sucks them up. And in some cases, like mercury, which are in the flu shots or mercury amalgams, the mercury is preferred over the iodine, and it, when that attaches to the thyroid, it actually damages it just like fluoride does.
Yeah, so when you get these deposition of toxins, that creates a lot of problems with the tissue. First of all, it can't run. If it's built on iodine, it can't run with these fake molecules that are attaching. And that creates a problem with what? Like, what's happening? It blocks the inherent energy, or how does that manifest as disease?
It can't make the hormone, first of all. But also, like with the case of fluoride, in the 1930s, they used fluoride when someone had a hyperthyroid to tone it down because it actually kills the thyroid cells. But it works so well, it actually killed the whole thyroid gland. So they stopped doing that, but then they put it in the tap water, and then we have this big epidemic of thyroid problems, which, again, what I'm seeing in my office is every week I see people with too much fluoride, but I see other reasons why the thyroid could be weak as well. But, yeah, you can actually kill your thyroid gland with these terrible chemicals.
Now, the whole endocrine system is kind of involved. That's another thing I don't like about endocrinology is they tend to be sometimes single focus, but I always use the analogy of the endocrine system's kind of like a symphony. So if if the violin and the strings are out of tune, something's wrong. The listener's like, wow, that's it. So it all has to focus with a conductor. The hypothalamus pituitary is the conductor. And I guess those were considered like sacred glands back in the Ayurvedic days, and still are, I guess, that those were like the pineal gland, and I guess they call those energy centers or chakras.
Yeah, I do talk about that in the book. So there's all kinds of issues, and as I go through these issues in the book, I keep a perspective. I make sure that the patient keeps a perspective on all this. What I talk about in the introduction is that because with medicine, we have to dissect the body into parts and say, all right, now we're talking about the endocrine system, and then we learn that. And then, oh, here's the digestive system, and we learn that. We tend to think that each system is working independently of each other. So therefore, we have a GI doctor, an ear, nose, and throat doctor, and they don't understand the communication between all the systems. So what I talk about in my book, I'm opening a thyroid book by talking about the gut and the liver. Because, like yesterday, I just saw a boy who has thyroid problem, and I felt his pulse, his thyroid's perfect. There's nothing wrong with it, and yet his hormones come up low. And when I tested further, he has liver damage from eating a very poor diet that the kids are growing up on here in America. It was very bad vegetable oils. So I have to treat the liver. See, it's all interrelated. It's all one body. So in the book, I talk about the fact that you can make the thyroid hormone. It's called T4. And T means tyrosine, and it's attached to 4-iodine. So it's very easy to understand. That's where that name comes from. But the T4 cannot get into your cell to exert its influence. And unless the hormone can get inside your cells of the body and it just remains outside the cell, it won't be able to work. And 80% of that conversion of T4 to T3, the T4 has to drop an iodine and become T3. 80% of that occurs in the liver, and 20% of that occurs in the friendly bacteria in the gut. Because of the overuse of pharmaceuticals and such a poor diet in America, most of the kids we're seeing nowadays have depletion of the friendly bacteria from too many immunizations, birth control pills, antibiotics.
Yeah,
and also the liver's overwhelmed from too many toxins going through it, that the thyroid is trying to work. It's making the hormones, but the hormones can't be used. So we have to keep that perspective that I always say anything can cause anything because the whole body's interconnected. I remember one day in chiropractic college, they said, just sit there and move your big toe, and we did. And he said, feel your neck, and we could feel the bones in our neck moving. Or if you chop a clove of garlic, you can taste it within a few seconds. So there's all this, the whole body's being influenced. It's not just the digestive system here is being influenced or the glandular system over here. It's not like that. So as I take on a patient, I'm always giving them that perspective. Otherwise, they're telling me they have a thyroid problem, and I'm saying, no, your thyroid's the victim of these other things, and that's all it is. It's just a victim.
Yeah, and again, depending upon your dosha, your constitutional thyroid problem will manifest as different types of body types and different types of problems. So that's why there's a myriad of issues with the thyroid that it seems like, it's sort of like a opposite of a panacea. It seems like everything can be related to the thyroid, everything from losing the hair on your eyebrow to going bald prematurely to coarse hair to weight gain, dry skin, fatigue, can't lose weight or can't gain muscle. So there's so many more, too. But you individualize, being studying Ayurveda and applying those principles, you individualize the treatments to the patient coming in the room. So let's give an example. Say somebody was very vata, had a vata imbalance. Maybe you can explain what that is and how you would approach that particular type of patient, because in vata, stress, sleep, and oils are paramount in helping balance that patient.
Yeah, and I have, in the very beginning of the book, I do say that I'm talking about the thyroid, but if you have a thyroid problem, first and foremost, you have to keep vata balanced. So I do describe what those different, these are elements in nature, vata, pitta, and kapha, the ancient doctors called them. But again, I try to make it more palatable to the Westerner. So vata, these three, they call them the three doshas. These three elements in nature are behind the scenes controlling everything. And when they get disrupted, then something more superficially will get disrupted, like the thyroid. So I say that we have to look beyond just the gland because there's something controlling it, and it's these elements in nature. And unless you learn how to keep them all balanced in your physiology, then your results of treating the thyroid or any problem will be minimal, if at all. So what we have to do then is teach the person what those three mean. So vata in nature is the element of dryness, coldness, and movement, like quickness. And so we want some quickness, like where we're doing our activities, but we don't want too much of that dosha. So we don't want to be hyper and rushing through the day and multitasking. We don't want to stay up late. We don't want to keep pushing and pushing like that, too much movement, because the glandular system, for one thing, can't handle that. It's almost like being in a constant state of fight or flight. That's the Western way of looking at it. Mm-hmm. Fight or flight is meant for an occasional response if there's a big stressor, like a car just fell or hit your four-year-old. Then you can just run out in the street. You know, you have that fight or flight going on, so you can save that child. Or you can run from a tiger, like that. But it's not something that you should chronically be feeling and living in fight or flight. But we all are doing that in our stressful society now. The Western Hemisphere, especially America, most people are Vata aggravated. That means we go through the day too quickly, we push too hard, and we don't incorporate enough rest into our day. And we think it's good that we can multitask and do three things at once. But it's good to reserve some time for rest or meditation or taking a nap, something like that, and always go to bed early. No later than 10 o'clock, the ancient doctor said, or the endocrine system gets too tired. It's almost like the endocrine glands, like the thyroid, the adrenal glands, are like the batteries that we run on, and we have to recharge them from time to time. They need good rest, and if we don't rest them, then they get exhausted. And so it shows up in the blood work, so the doctor says take thyroid hormone. But see, you can see the superficial way of looking at that. The better thing is to maybe rest and eat in a way that would balance Vata. So if Vata is the element of dryness, you want what's called an unctuous diet. So we teach the patients how to have good oils, good fats in the diet, and so on and so on, which you'll see in the book.
Yeah, and I mean, I'm sorry, go ahead.
So if you can balance the Vata, the thyroid perks right back up.
Yes, I've seen that, yeah. So, and fats are the basis of all. I mean, it's interesting that in Ayurveda they recognize that the importance of fats. You know, we live in this fat-phobic society,
yeah.
But...
It's right.
It's the basis of your hormones. It's amazing.
Yeah. So here's the thing. I kind of read some blogs and some books on nutrition, actually a lot, and I can see where we're trending. It used to be that our diet was so heavy with red meats and corned beef and hamburgers with cheese melted, and everyone got clogged arteries from that. So now we're overcorrecting, and everyone's saying, oh, fat is bad. But they're not thinking of good fats. They're just eliminating all fat, and they're going more towards this plant-based / vegan diet where there's no butter, no milk, you know, nothing from an animal. Well, here's the news. The endocrine system's hormones, the adrenal glands and the reproductive glands hormones are made out of cholesterol. And the thyroid gland, that tyrosine I was telling you about, is made from animal protein. And here's how wise the ancient doctors of India, who were strict vegetarians, and they didn't say you had to be vegetarian to be healthy, but they said that you need something from an animal at every meal. So if you're a vegetarian, that would come from milk and milk products. But there's different types of milk, and depends on what you can digest, and then there's a correct way to take it. So here in the West, we don't follow any of the guidelines they left us for taking milk, and we break all the rules, and as a result, we feel sick when we drink milk. So everyone's saying that milk is this poison. But according to those ancient rishis, if you have good quality milk that's unhomogenized, has a layer of cream at the top, you cook it with spices like cardamom, will help you digest the protein in the milk, cinnamon, and you put turmeric in it, that it becomes a nectar that absorbs immediately into every cell in the body. Unlike any other food, it takes about a month to absorb into all the cells. So the opposite's true, where we need some cholesterol, we need milk, but it's getting a bad rap here in the West, and a lot of the kids I'm seeing who are following these more vegan-based diets are getting into trouble with their endocrine systems.
Wow. Well, that's a good place to break. We're up half past the hour. We'll take a break and listen to the Natural Medicine Chest, our little mini modular program. And when we return, we'll talk more about Hashimoto's disease and the treatment of many different thyroid illnesses with our guest, Dr. Marianne Teitelbaum. Stay with us, folks.
This is Karen Hartglass, host of It's All About Food. and you're listening to PRN, your source for progressive, up-to-date, and inspirational information on nutrition and health.
On this edition of the Natural Medicine Chest, we'll discuss Sarsaparilla, or Smilax officinalis.
Sarsaparilla is a tropical plant which grows in South America, Mexico, and Guatemala. Although most Americans are familiar with it as a flavor enhancer for root beer, it has also been used for its beneficial properties for hundreds of years by many different cultures. In Roman times, the young shoots were eaten, and the mature vines were worn as garlands at festivals of Bacchus. According to ancient Roman writings, Sarsaparilla originated when the beautiful maiden, Smilax, was turned into a shrub after her love was slighted by the young crocus.
Sarsaparilla was brought to Europe in the 16th century by Spanish traders. A French physician, Nicolas Monardus, published a comprehensive account of Sarsaparilla as a treatment for syphilis in 1574. During Portuguese military operations in 1812, a British inspector general of hospitals noted its positive effect on syphilis patients. It has also been used in China for treatment of the same condition. Sarsaparilla was included in the United States Pharmacopeia until 1950 as a recommended treatment of secondary syphilis.
Sarsaparilla's medicinal action appears to be a result of binding bacterial endotoxins in the gut, thereby decreasing their absorption. This greatly reduces the stress on the liver and is likely responsible for its historic use as a tonic and blood purifier.
In a controlled study of 92 patients published in the New England Journal of Medicine in 1942, a chemically active component of Sarsaparilla, called sarsaparin, greatly improved psoriasis in 62% of the patients and resulted in complete clearance in 18%. Sarsaparilla is often recommended by naturopathic physicians for gout, arthritis, and psoriasis. Another folkloric use for Sarsaparilla is as a tonic for male sexual potency.
So, if you want a root beer flavored tea with a long history as a healthy tonic, reach for the Sarsaparilla in your natural medicine chest.
And we're back with more of the Natural Nursing. Dr. Z, I'm Dr. Z, Dr. Eugene Zamperone, and we're here with our guest, Dr. Marianne Teitelbaum, who is a chiropractor and also an authority in Ayurvedic medicine, and she wrote a fabulous book, which is really healing, not only healing the thyroid, although that's what she specialized in, but you could see how Ayurveda really applies to so many more conditions, as does the thyroid problem. Really, it's the whole body breaking down, and great to have you back.
Thank you.
Sure. Well, let's talk a little bit about some specific thyroid conditions that people might be suffering from. I know it's a Western way of thinking of things because it puts the disease in a box and gives it a label. I remember going to an Ayurvedic physician, and before I was trained in naturopathic medicine and Ayurvedic, and asking, well, what was the name of my disease? Because I had this vague constellation of symptoms, and the doctor wisely said, my first name's Eugene. It's Eugene's disease.
That's right. That's exactly
which I thought
right.
I thought was a little smug, yeah. But actually, it's not. It's really an individual expression of
that's
what's
right.
going on.
Yeah, it's just a combination of your own particular imbalances that someone has decided to call this thing, whatever it might be, Crohn's disease. But they're all just names, and it's very hard to back away from that name and realize that it's a set of all these imbalances, and you have to fix them so that this thing they're calling Crohn's or Hashimoto's will go away.
Yeah, now speaking of Hashimoto's, tell us a little bit about what that disease is in a Western term and contrast it with Ayurvedic thinking of this autoimmune type disease.
So if you're diagnosed with Hashimoto's, you'll see in your blood work high levels of antibodies. That means that your immune system, which used to have intelligence and it knew to attack viruses, bacteria, and other pathogens, it's now turned on you and it's attacking you. And in this case, it's attacking the thyroid gland. So now, again, even a youngster would know, then what do we need to do? I always ask kids when I'm lecturing around the United States and Canada, what would you do if someone had Hashimoto's? And even the kids say, fix the immune system. But the endocrinologists don't do that. They just put you again on the thyroid hormone. And meanwhile, the blood work gets worse and worse. The antibodies keep going up and up and up, see, because they have no way of detecting the reasons why the immune system has decided to attack you. So in my book, I talk about the three parts of the immune system, which are the friendly bacteria in the gut, the liver, and the bone marrow. All three are your immune system. That's where they reside. They all play different roles, but they're all balancing your immune system so that it doesn't go out of control and attack you. So the friendly bacteria in the gut are disturbed from so many pharmaceuticals, like we just stated, especially antibiotics, birth control pills, and immunizations. The liver is overwhelmed, and most people in this modern era, with the amount of toxins it has to filter out. And then the bone marrow is a very deep tissue, and the ancient doctors said, don't let toxins reach the bone marrow. It's very deep within the bone, and that's where the immune system cells are born. But they couldn't have foreseen that in this modern era, over the last 100 years, since the onset of pharmaceuticals and pesticides, these autoimmune diseases have increased by 500%. And that's because they can't tell just from researching their pharmaceuticals, but many of them make their way immediately into the bone marrow. Like if you get a flu shot within minutes, those chemicals are in the bone marrow. We could feel the bone marrow in the pulse. So we can see what's happening with all the pharmaceuticals, whereas the doctors can't. So then it's our job to clean the bone marrow, fix the liver, clean that out, and also regrow the friendly bacteria in the gut. But there's one little thing that I talk about a lot in the book. What's happening to the liver, it's not only toxic, but it's overheated, because just like rainwater, which is alkaline, when it picks up air pollution, it becomes acid rain. The liver, over time, from filtering so many air pollution molecules you're breathing in, so many skin care products you're putting on the skin, which from the skin absorb directly in the blood, so many pharmaceuticals, so much bad food, bad oils, canola oil, safflower, sunflower, making their way into your liver, the liver starts to overheat from all these acid toxins going through it. So when the liver overheats, it starts attacking. That's why food allergies are so prevalent. When the food comes in, it's attacking the food. It's supposed to break the food down correctly and send it on its way. But in this modern era of overutilization of too many pharmaceuticals, the liver's overheated, cranky, and it attacks the food. And in the same way, when the liver overheats, it pushes your immune system into this attack mode. And on top of that, if you've lost the friendly bacteria from a few rounds of antibiotics or birth control pills in your life, now you've set the stage as a perfect storm for autoimmune to develop.
Now, I was always trained in my Western naturopathic medicine that things like taraxacum and milk thistle and burdock are all good blood cleansers, and they have a cooling energy. But that's one thing in your book that seems like a disagreement in Ayurveda and Western herbal medicine. Can you, and also the inappropriate use of turmeric. Talk about that, because I find that interesting, because it's a little different paradigm than I was trained in.
You know, when my teacher first came from India, he was sent here because he's a master herbalist. He knew all the 700 herbs they use in Ayurveda. So he was here making formulas for the first Ayurvedic company in America. And so he started training me one-on-one in person in my office. And I remember the first time he came, he put people on all the herbs, including the herbs that we use also to clean out the liver. And the next time he came back and felt their pulses, he said to me, okay, we can't do this anymore. He said, I've never seen this. I've just come from India. But I'm immersed in a culture now that has a very poor diet. He explained to me what his mother made for him growing up, and I told him what my mother made. He was in shock what I ate growing up. And he said that between the very poor diet and the overuse of pharmaceuticals, that our liver was shot and that we had to be very careful now that we don't heat it. And so many herbs, including, I would say, like 9/10 of the Ayurvedic herbs, will heat the liver as they clean it, even some that might be even a little cooling. So you have to, what he had to do, I remember he turned to me and said, I don't know what to do now. He said, I have all these herbs and we can't use them because everyone's liver is just attacking them. And the same way it's attacking the food, it's turning it into poison. So the person registers this as a food allergy. He said, it's also attacking the herbs, even our good Ayurvedic herbs, he said, or even like you say, milk thistle or burdock root. They're all wonderful things, dandelion. Turmeric is considered the best friend to the liver, but these all contain a little bit of heat. He said it's very hard to clean the liver without heating it. In fact, in the book, I have the one herb he told me that can do it. It's called Mankhand that doesn't have any heating effect, so I have to use this a lot in my practice. The other one is called Bhumi Amla. Bhumi Amla is known to cool the heat in the liver, but it brings the intelligence back to the liver, so it stops attacking the food like that. Stops attacking the thyroid, and it brings that intelligence back. So I see what you're saying. It's just that in this modern era, in this country, we have to figure out another way to do it. So my teacher made what are called transdermal creams, where he gives the herbs through the skin, or he just captured the pranic energy, the vibration, or the intelligence of that herb, took out the crude herb, and by putting, it's almost like a homeopathic version of the herbs, putting drops of that in water and sip it slowly so it slowly comes into the liver, then we could treat these autoimmune diseases. But up until then, we weren't able to treat anything because he had only just brought the crude herbs.
Interesting, yeah. This Mankhand is interesting. I'm looking at the Latin, alocasia. So it's a cousin to our like elephant ears, which are all alocasias. So it would probably use the tuber of this particular plant. Interesting. And then the other one, Tinospora cordifolia guduchi. That's a very interesting one that people believe is like one of these rejuvenating herbs.
Yes, that was my teacher's favorite herb. So I talk a lot about it in the book, and I tell the story of it. But the reason it was my teacher and his father's favorite herb, his father was a great Ayurvedic physician as well, was because it's the only herb that can reach the bone marrow and clean it. So it's important for all of our autoimmune cases, but see, the leaf of the guduchi plant is too heating, so we can't use it. But the stem of the plant, and I talk about this in the book, if you juice the stem and dry it and grind it into a powder, they call it guduchi sattva, and that stem of the guduchi is very cooling. See, that's how specific we have to be. So that we can use for autoimmune because it can go into the bone marrow and clean it. And it can go into the liver and clean out old toxins that have been sitting there. Most of my patients are in shock when I tell them, you know, you're 43, but you still have residues of the birth control pills you took 20 years ago in your liver, or maybe, you know, the 30 rounds of antibiotics when you were younger. The effects of it are still stuck in the liver. The liver was overwhelmed and couldn't get rid of that. But see, guduchi can slowly but surely leach that out of there. So it's this wonderful, amazing herb that Americans really need to learn about more.
Yeah, and moringa, that's one. It's funny, I learned about that on one of my trips to Jamaica. Myself and the natural nurse, we do these trips to Jamaica, and it was growing in Jamaica as a big tree. And then I talked to one of the local West Indian botany experts, and he goes, oh, yeah, it was brought over by the Indian people, and now it grows all over Jamaica, and it's become like a superfood and a super medicine. And you talk about moringa in your book.
I do, and you'll see I list the amounts of nutrients that it has. It's an amazing array, but see, moringa can also, moringa is more of a food, whereas guduchi is the herb that can clean the bone marrow. Moringa also can go in and clean the bone marrow as well.
Yeah, and you have some nice recipes of how you can, you know, add sort of things to kind of clean out your liver and whatnot. So that's really great. So that's very important, of course, in Hashimoto's. You also talk about ashwagandha and turmeric, which are used for autoimmune diseases, but you have to use them cautiously.
Yes, the ashwagandha. In fact, the other herb we use besides ashwagandha is called shilajit. And it's an ironic thing that the two herbs that we use for the thyroid are too heating to use in this modern era. So my teacher had to devise ways, again, through the skin or these little glyceride drops that we use, to get the shilajit and the ashwagandha in. See, turmeric is a heating spice, and everything in Ayurveda is classified as to what happens after it comes in. Some of the herbs are cooling, some are heating. Turmeric has a heating quality, but they consider it the best friend to the liver, they call it, because it can help the liver in its efforts to detox the patient. But it is heating, so here in America, lots of patients are taking capsules of it, and they're overwhelming an already heated liver. The best thing is to cook turmeric into a fat like ghee or milk. That's why that golden milk recipe has come about, where you simmer milk with a few pinches of turmeric in it. The fat molecules will deliver the turmeric across the cell wall. All the cell walls in your body are made of cholesterol. So ghee and milk are seen as this great vehicle to take herbs into the body and spices. So turmeric needs that vehicle or that piggyback ride to get in your cells. But milk and ghee are considered cooling. So by cooking the turmeric in milk or ghee, it'll cool down the heat of that spice. So they're all wonderful. It's just that people have to be aware how to use them.
Now, one thing about Ayurveda, and in your book you talk about it, teaches is kind of like how to live between office calls. That's I think that was a famous book by Bernie Siegel, How to Live Between Office Visits. But the ancient ways actually taught you what to do, routines, how to live. We're never taught that in Western medicine. There's nothing. I didn't grow up teaching how to live. I mean, you look at your parents and, okay, maybe you emulate that, but they didn't have any teachers. So we're kind of like, you know, wandering people, you know, without a purpose. And Ayurvedic medicine teaches us that.
We're definitely rudderless here in the West. When I take a new patient in, I can tell they are totally in the dark about their health. But I've watched this change come. I have 10 hours worth of lectures on my website that I ask them to listen to.
Oh, wow.
And then read my book. And as they come in, I teach them correct diet, correct cleansing. After they've been coming about a half a year or a year, they become Ayurvedic experts. And they know exactly, you should see their health returns. They become very wise as to their daily routine, the diet, the cleanses, and they're no longer in the dark. So our patients that come here are so happy, and they know that they're getting to the root of their problems. But you're right. In the book, I have a section. It's called Dinacharya, and Dinacharya means that, your daily routine. And the ancient doctors described every 4 hours of the day the elements in nature that are most active during that time, and the best thing for you to do during that time. For instance, they said 10 at night to 2 in the morning, you should be asleep. And they talk about why that is. And they said that people were made to be asleep when the sun goes down and awake when the sun comes up, and that breaking that one law of nature sets the stage for a disease to begin. It's one of the very first imbalances that are created from going to bed late, see, and waking up late. You're going against nature there, so then disease can start to grow in your body.
Yeah, and then, you know, we've spent time about diet. Certainly one size doesn't fit all. There's, you know, some folks that will do well on kind of warming foods and some folks that won't and some folks that do better with fats and vice versa and sweets and vice versa. So it's very individualized. I think it's very important to go see an Ayurvedic practitioner so they can, you know, try to figure out your constitution. And it's more complex than just taking a quiz online, an Ayurvedic quiz. That gives you a general idea of your constitution, but you have to understand what the ojas are and the dhatus, the health of your tissues and the channels, and it's more complex than that. I know from studying it.
But excuse me, one thing that all the patients tell me as I teach them is that it's very easy to understand. You're kind of using the Sanskrit names. I'd show them what that means in English. And they say that it all makes good sense. You know, for instance, I teach them about the physical channels in the body, like the arteries are one type of channel. But then there's other channels, like the delicate ear canals, or channels that carry urine, or sweat, or toxins, or lymphatic fluids. And then we talk about foods that could shrink those channels that you want to avoid, or clog them, or inflame them. You'll see in the book I'll talk about those too.
Yeah.
So learning, people really get that idea of these physical channels. And then little by little, I always tell them it's like putting a puzzle together. You have this one piece that, okay, I get that, and then we do this little piece. And then after so many weeks or months go by, you have the puzzle completed, and you say that I understand everything now, and it's really not as hard as I originally thought. And a lot of it's common sense. It's just that we don't listen to the cues our body's giving us. Our body's telling us, oh, my pitta is high, I have to eat now. So you eat and you pacify pitta. That's a digestive fire. Or I'm tired, I need to go to sleep. So instead of pushing and going on the computer or playing video games, you go to sleep then. So a lot of it is just your body's giving you cues. It's whether or not you listen to them.
Yeah, that's very true. I mean, illness is cues from the body. It's the symbolism of the way our body speaks. Symptoms mean things to people, and we're here as practitioners to help, you know, kind of teach people what this symbolic language means. You know, when people have thyroid problems, they're not going to come in and say, oh, Dr. Teitelbaum, I think I have a thyroid problem. They're going to say, no, my hair's falling out.
Mm-hmm.
My eyebrows are falling out. I'm gaining weight. I have no energy. My doctor said, my allopathic physician said I have high cholesterol. And, you know, maybe other myriad of things. And we're there, okay, well, we can help you. And your book is great to get people to understand not only Ayurveda, but the body itself.
Yeah, it's not just about the thyroid, but it has all the principles of how to keep your body healthy, and as a result, your thyroid gland stays healthy.
You're like, so who knew
really
that
about the everything.
Thyroid had to do with your digestive system and toxins
and, every
and the bone marrow and nutrients and diet and sleep and gut flora. I mean, it's just, that's what's so nice about holistic medicine in general, whether you're, you know, studying from the naturopathic perspective or chiropractic or Ayurveda. But, you know, Ayurveda is one of those ancient traditions, like you said, that the principles are still the same thing with, like, TCM, too. I revere that system as well.
Yeah.
You know, these are systems that haven't changed. And, you know,
right.
The doctors say, oh, they're all outdated modes. No, they're not. The same stuff applies now.
Yeah.
They were just talking a different language, I guess, back then.
It's just a different language, but if you can teach the person what it means, they love it. And I'll tell you, I think that Ayurveda is poised to have a great influence in America over the next 100 years because it's so entrenched in very good common sense practices for our health. You'll see when you read the book.
Yeah, I hope that we see schools and licensing and programs of Ayurveda, just like we've seen chiropractic and naturopathic medicine and other types of alternative medicine, TCM. For some reason, Ayurvedic medicine never really took a bite out of the healthcare in America like TCM did in the 70s when I think Nixon's aide went to a acupuncturist in China and got helped and thus ignited the interest in traditional Chinese medicine. Now it's licensed, I think, in all 50 states or close to it. Will we see the same thing in Ayurveda, you think, in the next 30 years or so?
Oh, definitely. Almost every new patient I get doesn't really know Ayurveda, and by the time I teach them it, they totally love it. And we have so many referrals here, I can't keep up with the new patients. Like, if you call today, we can't get you in the office till October. So we have this tremendous waiting list, but the people are knocking down our door to get in here and learn this. They love it so much. Because, again, I'm making it easy for them to understand. It's just that Ayurveda is very new in America. It's only been here, you know, 30-some years. And up until now, the practitioners have been using it very generally. That's why, again, I want to write books on all the diseases and show people that it's not just some general, you know, thing like go to bed early and wake up early and eat healthy, but you can treat diseases very specifically. And so I think we're kind of waiting for practitioners to start writing books like this so we can see what it does have to offer.
Well, thanks so much for your this book. It's a great book, Healing the Thyroid with Ayurveda, Marianne Teitelbaum, D.C., and it's put out by, I think, Healing Arts Press, and I guess you can get it, you can go on their website, healingartspress.com, or I'm sure it's available at all the major book outlets. Any last words before we sign off, Dr. Teitelbaum?
No, one thing that I'm very happy about with the book, when people read it, they all come back to me saying, I totally understand it, I love it, and they also feel that it's groundbreaking because the other books that have been written on the thyroid, they're starting to talk about the friendly bacteria. Everybody's talking about the gut microbiome, but we're talking about some things that are well beyond that, like this problem with the liver overheating and also the bone marrow. So this book's going to places that other books before have not gone to, so I'm very excited about that, and the patients love the book.
Well, have a great afternoon, and thank you very much for contributing to our program, The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. Take care.
Thank you for having me.
And that does it for another edition of The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z, folks. We want you to stay healthy. Bye-bye.